troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here again. Kevin, what's going on, my friend?
Just having another week of sheltering in place. I'm still subscribing. I kind of having a good time getting work done from home and doing lots of Zoom interviews and everything else, and, you know, as usual, meetings and lots of talks with students about science communication. Good times.
Yeah, well, it seems like it's more fun where you are out in the boonies because there's just lots of stuff to get lost in, I think. But if you live in the suburbs or the city, everything's closed still. So you're just kind of like, well, I guess I'll watch more Netflix.
Yeah, out here there's nothing anyway. So you don't really notice that it's not open because it's not here. You know, what am I? You know, the Circle K still has everything you need there. And, that's what's here at the stoplight where I live. And so you don't really miss anything by it being closed because it's never really there to begin with.
Well, maybe you get more creative. You know, you start shooting rattlesnakes with shotguns because you're like, well, what else am I going to do? And that's maybe that's a story I'll tell another day. But let's jump into these stories we're going to talk about. So first up, the World Health Organization said just the other day that asymptomatic COVID-19 patients very rarely spread the disease, and then they walked it back the very next day. So we're going to get into what we actually know about this situation, because there's been a lot of back and forth. Now, a new study says the pandemic may cause women to cheat on their partners. So we're going to look at the study, look at their methodology, and see what they actually found. Another team of researchers has developed a glyphosate testing method that might help scientists dispel some misinformation that's going around the internet about Bayer's Roundup herbicide. And then finally, fraud is rampant in the organic food industry, and it's so bad, in fact, that it may actually end the organic food industry as we know it. So we're going to dive into that as well, because that's going to be very interesting. But Kevin, I think the biggest thing we need to talk about is this this issue with the World Health Organization and asymptomatic COVID cases. So what's going on here? I'm honestly kind of lost.
Well, the story comes to us from an Ed Cara article in Gizmodo from June 10th, and he covers kind of what happened with the backtrack, but the story's even bigger than what he presents. There was a big blow-up last week because Maria Van Kerkhove, who is the WHO's technical lead on COVID-19, she made the comment that then the quotation was, from the data we have, it still seems to be rare that an asymptomatic person actually transmits onward to a secondary individual. It's very rare. Now, she said this not as a major statement by the WHO, but made it as kind of an offhand comment during a question and answer session. So she was asked by a reporter during the section about asymptomatic transmission, and that was her answer. The problem is that it doesn't fit what is actually known, and her discussion was given a lot of authority, when actually it's pretty clear that asymptomatic spread is a part of the transmission cycle.
So just to be clear, did she mean to say what everybody thinks she did, and now they're walking it back, or was she trying to say something else, and the media and the public got the issue convoluted?
Yeah, I think that's what it is. Really what she was trying to say is it's very difficult to detect asymptomatic transmission because you don't know that people are symptomatic. You don't know that someone is a carrier if they're not symptomatic, right? It's mm-hmm. difficult to assess how many people are actually carrying the virus and then if they're shedding the virus, because you may have the virus but not be especially infectious. And as we say, almost every time we deal with a COVID-19 story, we're still learning all the time. And nobody knows for sure. And so I think that is the uncertainty that came across in her statement, because she was saying that we don't have the evidence of it. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And so I think that's where the confusion came in.
So from what I understand, the biggest issue is trying to separate pre-symptomatic cases from asymptomatic cases. And because the virus has such a long incubation period, I believe it's a couple of weeks. And so that makes it really difficult to distinguish, well, who is actually infected and who's going to develop symptoms, and who either isn't infected or who is infected and isn't going to develop symptoms. And so is that basically the crux of the issue? It's really hard to suss that out.
Exactly. And then put on top of this, all the things they're learning about potential genetic overlays that we've discussed here on the podcast, all of the other potential factors that determine if somebody will actually come down with a COVID-19 infection or a SARS-CoV-2 infection. And so it's really difficult to understand the dynamics of transmission. They just know that it happens and it's possible. And so when the WHO comes out and says, well, it's nothing to worry about, even if it's an offhand quip, there's at least some big faction of the media and the public that wants to deny that this is a real thing, that's going to grab onto that and popularize that, or at least foment division based upon those words. Of course, the WHO has done a great job at coming out and clarifying, and many statements made by many different agencies that you got to keep that mask on, got to keep your distance, stay home. And we see the trends really reversing on all those things. And we see the numbers creeping up, at least in terms of number infections. So I think the numbers bear out that her statement was not consistent with what we know about the disease.
Okay. And I've heard some conflicting statements, and maybe you can clarify this. If not, that's okay. But I've heard some academics who I respect and who have been very good on this issue say, we still haven't done a big enough study to figure out who's asymptomatic and who's pre-symptomatic. And that is what we still have to do. And now that we have as much testing capacity as we have, we can do that and definitively answer this question. But until that study's done, we just have to kind of not shut up, but we have to pull back and say, look, we're working on it and just let it lie there. Is that a fair assessment of where we're at?
Absolutely. No, that's a very fair assessment. And so there's a precautionary stance here that we know it's possible to spread asymptomatic when asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic. And so, you know, that's the point. We don't know enough about it yet to be able to give definitive guidance. And so take the safe route.
Right on. Well, maybe just a little humility for everybody. And we talked about this a little last week, but everyone just chill out, because it just appears we don't know as much as we think we do. But anyway, let's talk about cheating during the coronavirus, Kevin. What was your first reaction to this study?
Well, it seemed rather curious. And, you know, I was looking at the original article, and it wasn't as exciting as I originally thought it would be. But there, if you look at some other statistics, it turns out that it may be right. So this is by Martin Graf of Psychology Today, who distilled a number of studies that were done recently, one in particular. But what the question is during a illness, do women seek to evolutionarily guard their germline, meaning that, you know, are they going to try to find more sexual partners during a time when health appears to be threatened? So it starts with saying males can go out and, you know, fertilize, you know, different person every day if they wanted to. Not a good move for child support, but the idea is that males can do that. Women can only really land one kid every whatever it is, you know, 12 months, really, realistically. And so the idea was, evolutionarily, does this put pressure on women who are not pregnant during a time of illness threat to seek additional partners? And the idea would be, you know, to be able to preserve your genetics, pass on your genes. That's what we all are basically mechanisms to pass genes forward. And so they did some studies on this. The actual study they did was ways on testing their perceived vulnerability and then connecting that to sexual behaviors.
All right. So I have to, you have to correct me on certain things here if I make mistakes, but I read this article and then I read the paper that you're just describing, and it just seems frankly ridiculous to me. And I rarely say that about the stuff that we cover, but just for example, the experiments they did were surveys where they asked women about their sexual proclivities and their concern about infectious disease and so on. And they did a bunch of statistics and came up with the results. But this is basically, it's a survey of 133 women. And so I don't find that compelling, because these sort of questionnaire-based studies are typically very unreliable. And like in the world of nutrition and food science, people will answer these food frequency questionnaires and they will lie to the point that what they're reporting they ate wouldn't keep them alive. You know, so I'm highly skeptical of these kind of survey-based studies, because you can draw any conclusion you want. Am I out in the wilderness here?
No, you're exactly in the wilderness. Exactly not in the wilderness, whatever that is, the anti-wilderness, where you know, what you're saying is true. The idea of self-reporting, especially around ideas of diet and sexuality and exercise, are typically skewed, and people don't necessarily report their, as you say, proclivities with great accuracy. And this is a big part of this, I'm sure. And I thought the same thing you did. The other part of this is that they said that they didn't see the same thing happening in men. And my guess is it's because men you would survey would always be on. So how do you have an increase when dudes are like, hey, yeah, every day, whatever, you know? So, who's the that narrows it down. Antonio Cromartie, right? The cornerback from the Jets who had, I think he has something like 16 kids from 12 different wives. But there's males seem to be pretty on top of this. Insert joke here. And so the thing is, though, is that when you look at some other statistics that are out there and other things that are happening, it's of interest. I just kind of Googled COVID and promiscuity. And it turns out that Ashley Madison, which is that website for hookups, you know this thing? I mean, I don't
right,
know.
Yeah. Well, it's for married people, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's the deal. I've only heard. All right. So, but they say that they have signups are way high.
So what I wonder, though, is that couldn't you just say that people are sick of being stuck in their homes with their significant other? That seems like a more realistic explanation than this idea that even women subconsciously are trying to make sure their children are immune to diseases. You know what I mean? It just seems like a stretch.
No, and I think that's borne out in this article as well, is that they talk about a number of cases of, you know, people just being lonely, and somehow when locked up with your significant other can actually make you more lonely because they're always there, you know, or something convoluted like that. But it turns out that this idea of virtual affairs, because you can't really hook up physically. So there's been a lot of this cyber sex stuff going on. But this is really happening at a pretty high rate. And it, one explanation could be that desire to go out and find a mate because of this perception of health vulnerability. I mean, it sounds like a stretch, but it's a hypothesis that could probably use a lot more illumination.
Sure. Well, I don't know how plausible this would be or how practical it would be, but couldn't you maybe follow people over a period of time and see that, okay, when an infectious disease breaks out, they tend to be more promiscuous, or, you know, they've gotten married multiple times, or there's more divorces over this period. Wouldn't that be, I guess, like an epidemiological approach? Wouldn't that be a more realistic way to approach a question like this?
Yeah, maybe. I think, you know, it's a difficult one because, once again, you're counting on things like self-reporting and surveys, things like that, around a very sensitive behavior. But it's one of these ideas that, you know, that the perception of threat would lead to this promiscuity. You know, the other way to do this would be potentially in animals that don't have the same social overlays, that animals that are under stress, may be more likely to find mates because they would feel as though their potential for reproduction may be limited. And that may trigger something. I know it does in plants. So in a lot of plants, when the going gets tough, you know, you're getting a little dry or it's getting a little hot or something's not right. One of the things you can do is flower to make some more seeds to move the genetics forward. So, you know, nature tends to replicate their mechanisms, and maybe there's something to that.
I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But speaking of sexy topics, let's talk about pesticide chemistry. and specifically, and the science on this one is quite complicated. So break it down for us, Kevin. So this is a new test that can detect trace quantities of glyphosate at much less, it's less expensive, and it's even maybe a mobile test compared to the laboratory options you have right now. So talk about this, if you would.
Yeah, let's talk about creating the need first. And so we know that issues with glyphosate, we've discussed them a bit here, mostly in that here's a relatively safe, probably one of the world's best tested chemicals that has never been shown to be problematic in any meaningful way, and has been a subject of controversy because of the 2015 IARC decision that changed its classification to a probable carcinogen. Making it the same hazard, not risk, but the same hazard as pickled vegetables, red meat, and night shift work. And so it's a classification that allowed trial lawyers to begin to identify cases of people who had unusual cancers, and keying off some very slight statistical correlations, were able to build a case that there's an association with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And this has been supported by other curious statistical machinations and massaging that give these associations. So one way to figure this out is to be a little bit more vigilant about where glyphosate is. And people have made claims that it's in breast milk and in air and in water and in the rain and all this stuff. And when you really drill down and read those papers carefully, you find out that it is detected, but on the edge of being there. So in the order of, you know, low parts per billion, which is seconds in 32 years. So it's barely there. But there's a lot of activist groups that claim it's everywhere, and they contract out companies to do the test, and the companies might detect something that's near the limit of detection, but it's in the noise. You know, it's not in a good quantifiable range where you can know how much is there. It's just some very small amount that they can call a positive detection. And of course, activist groups run with that, and they'll say, ah, it's in your pretzels, it's in your whatever. So here's an example of a group that's now used a specific kind of new sensor where they actually use the enzyme's binding activity and affinity for specific substrate, glyphosate, to be able to create an optical readout that's highly quantifiable and highly sensitive. And so the advantage here is a better test that maybe is portable, fast, and cheap. And that may help straighten out whether it's really there or not.
So could this be used in different substances? Because with the breast milk example that you briefly mentioned, I believe that Moms Across America, the activist group that really blew that up into a national story, they were using an assay that isn't appropriate for breast milk. Is that right? And so it's very possible that their results were erroneous anyway. And so would something like this help mitigate that situation?
It sure would. Yeah, the test that has been mostly used is what's called a competitive ELISA. And this is a colorimetric test, meaning you get a variation in color based upon how much of the compound in question is there. And I could go through the whole chemistry of this, but suffice it to say that it works great with water. And it is very reproducible, very reliable. The problem is that when you start putting in secondary compounds into the chemistry, introducing things from, as they say, complex matrices like breast milk or wine or beer, you're going to get false positives and some degree of signal that's not coming from the glyphosate, but that's coming from something else, which is interfering with the complex chemistry of this particular assay. And so this is why these are never very reliable to use those techniques. There's other techniques that have been used that are very sensitive, that are correct. LC-MS, it's a liquid chromatography mass spec. That's good. And when that's used, that's probably pretty accurate. But these really quick and dirty tests are doing nothing more but interjecting noise into an important conversation.
Right. And that's really significant. And you and I both know what happened to Shelley Maguire, who back in, 2014 and 15 was at the University of Washington. And Moms Across America just lambasted her. You know, at one point, I think they were calling her up at home and saying she has the blood of children on her hands because she did. I think she helped develop a new method for detecting glyphosate in breast milk. And she debunked their study and said, oh, there's really nothing here. And then they just went after her. So something like this hopefully might put an end to that before you get an academic who's, you know, effectively assassinated online.
Yeah, she really took a lot of heat. And she is actually going to be a guest on my podcast in the next couple of weeks. And we're going to discuss what she went through because she's at a different university now. A lot of things changed for her and she put up with a lot of garbage. And I think that this is something we're seeing, unfortunately, more and more with those of us who are academics who speak out on these issues and try to correct these activists, is that then we become the target. And she was really, unfortunately, targeted. This kind of assay, if it turns out to be as good as they say it is and can be manufactured on a widespread level, could be very powerful in helping to at least deflate the claims that this stuff is everywhere in dangerous amounts.
Yeah, very good stuff. And that reminds me, I wrote an article about Maguire's situation, and it's on the GLP, so I'll make sure to post that. But they were doing evil stuff. I mean, her university told her to shut up and not respond to the accusations. And, you know, she talked to US Right to Know at one point, and they were like, you know, Gary Ruskin said, you know, I know you're up to no good and we're going to find out what it is. Just like this really evil, you know, evil behavior. So, you know, we'll move on. But all that to say, you know, this test has.
Let me throw in one more quick one on that. Another pseudo academic character in this entire conversation also was kind of trying to slime her. He was trying to work with her and say, let's go get lunch and talk about what you know about this. And how can we find if it's in breast milk? And how do we prove it's in there? You know, and she was just amazed by this. And so she's got some good stories to tell. And I'm really excited to talk to her about it because at this point, she's willing to talk. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I won't ruin the surprises then because it's a really fascinating story about how they first approached her. But anyways, we'll leave it there and let's talk about organic food fraud, Kevin. And this is a bigger deal than I think most people realize. So what story are we talking about here?
Well, this is a story that's probably a tip of an iceberg. And this is by Amelia Pang at Mother Jones, where she says certified organic lacks USDA regulations, encourage fraud in profitable food, organic food sector. Now, you know, and I know there's a lot of people who have very passionate opinions about this particular topic. I always am kind of tempered because I look at organic farmers as just another kind of farmer that's creating a product and playing by a set of production rules to meet a demand. And we can argue whether that demand is real or not, whether it's ethical or not, whether it's, you know, whatever. But I look at it strictly from a land grant scientist side, that my job is to take care of farmers. I don't care what they grow or how they do it. It's my job to serve them. And so I'm 100% for organic farmers, and they're some of the hardest working people I know, and at least in my area. And the fact is that a lot of organizations, because of the money angle, are starting to erode trust in organic, in the organic concept, because they're introducing non-organic stuff into the supply chains. And so the article here talks about a number of cases where this has happened. You know, just personally, I think it's going to be a lot more widespread than people would realize.
And I believe this issue goes back maybe even to the early 2000s, because there's been multiple cases of farmers being charged with fraud for selling conventional grain as organic grain. There's been instances of farmers using synthetic fertilizer and pesticides. And at one point, I think it was in 2012, the USDA found that like 43% of the organic produce samples they tested had synthetic pesticides on them, not in amounts that are harmful by any means, but absolutely not up to the standard of organic, which completely bans those substances, And so this seems to be a real deep problem that's been going on for years. Is there any way to prevent it or address it?
Well, it all has to be done in regulation and with very strict testing. And, you know, the article talks about a company, it's a Turkish company called Tiryaki, which like teriyaki, it always sounds like Tiryaki. They're this massive, massive company that exports grain. And Turkey and other countries in the region there have a very strong production and very strong grain producers. Ukraine, a number of other countries over on that part of the world. And unfortunately, they don't always play by the rules. Now, if you think about it, if that ship that's being loaded with containers full of grain going to the U.S., if you can say it's organic, you're going to double the value of that contain of that ship. And most of that grain is going for animal feed. And so the issue is, how do you know if an animal was fed organic food or not? Well, usually it's broke if it does, if it is, you know, that's one way to tell. There's nothing in its wallet. Animals, but the animals, if they get organic feed, their food, their meat and milk and other products are largely the same. And a good example here says that, that something like 70% of organic soybeans are imported. And 40% of organic corn is imported and used to create organic livestock. So all of that grain that's coming from these other places, because in the U.S., there's not a huge amount of organic production in those kinds of commodity grain crops, probably because we have inspectors and got to play by the rules. And, you know, and it's really hard to do. It's extremely difficult. When you think about how you can limit the inputs to, you can't use certain seeds, can't use certain pesticides or fertilizers, makes it really tough.
So there's a certain catch-22 here, from at least from reading this article. So for example, if the USDA really started monitoring these imports and rejecting them if they don't meet the standards, because as you, I think as you mentioned, the margins in organic farming are so slim that this could really eliminate the bulk of organic farming. So that's one possibility. But then the other issue is if it's not addressed, then consumers lose complete faith in the organic label and then the industry dies that way. So is it really, I guess what I'm asking is this really solvable in any meaningful sense?
Yeah, it sounds like you framed that very well, that it's a lose-lose, because one side is that you can't, it's not sustainable economically, and it's not sustainable if you don't have public trust, because who wants to pay, you know, 50% to double the amount for fruits and vegetables or meat if it's not guaranteed to be what you think it is? And, you know, you're paying for that halo, you're paying for something that you can't test for. That it's a supply chain monitoring question. You have to be assured that everything in that chain from the producer on up is, starting back with the producer, that the producer is using methods and techniques that are consistent with the U.S. organic standards. And, you know, there's very difficult to do that, especially in a place like Turkey,
All right. Well, maybe one thing we should mention just in passing is that there's nothing wrong with organic food. It's perfectly nutritious and safe to eat in most cases, but it's also not better for you. And so, you know, when we're talking about this affecting the organic industry, that really sucks for those farmers who are following the rules and, you know, playing fair. But again, maybe I'm being a little too speculative here, but it seems like when your industry is based on the way your product is marketed instead of the quality of the product itself, you open yourself up to this kind of abuse. What do you think about that?
Yeah, you live by the halo, you die by the halo. And it's true, you know, that's at some point it moves from over your head to around your neck because you can't, they're appealing to a consumer-driven demand that doesn't have a substantiation that you can measure in terms of the quality of the food. So when you're dealing with that kind of ethereal feel-good aspect of food, you're also prone to that going away very easily once a consumer doesn't have trust. Once a consumer doesn't trust that what's in that, you know, $10 head of lettuce is really a $10 head of lettuce, or, you know, the organic turkey from Turkey is not really organic, you know, it hasn't been fed organic grain. And there's no way you can test whether it was or it wasn't. So that kind of thing, you know, could be something that would really threaten an industry. So it's an interesting thing we'll watch as it unfolds, especially as more and more organic stuff comes from China. And, you know, we know that China is not always the most stringent about what exactly, you know, goes in the bag. And, you know, to put conventional peas into a bag and put organic on it to sell it for twice the price is not a bridge too far for folks who are cutting baby formula with melamine. You know, or putting it in pet food or whatever that was. So, yeah. You know, so it's something that as an organic consumer, I would be very skeptical and always being very careful about asking questions about supply chain and not just paying more for something because it has a few words on the label.
Wise words to live by, as always. Kevin Folta closing us out with some useful wisdom. Anyway, so we know Shelley Maguire is going to be on Talking Biotech. What else is going on over there on your other podcast?
Well, this last weekend was the 5-year anniversary of the podcast, which is pretty amazing. 5 complete years and 244 episodes, about 1.3 million downloads. And now we're going to start moving into the next 6th year. And I hate to say, I think we've got a lot of really good momentum and never had more downloads. And it's been a really great experience. This last weekend, the best guests I've had so far, I think, has been Dr. Rob Fraley. He was a World Food Prize winner, former chief technical officer at Monsanto Company. And we talk about everything from the first genetically engineered plants when he was on that team, all the way up through changes through his time in corporate science, and what he sees for the future of farming. And it's a fascinating interview that I think you'll really like.
Very, very cool. Go check that out, as always. My hearty endorsement to Talking Biotech. But anyway, so at Kevin Fultz on Twitter, at Cam J. English, geneticliteracyproject.org, Spotify, iTunes. Whew, been a long week. So thank you guys for listening. We will see you next time.